Expert HR Weekly, compliance, good practice and benchmarking for UK HR professionals.
Hello and welcome to this week's Expert HR Weekly with me, Susan Dennehy. Having someone off work long-term sick can cause a lot of problems for an employer, particularly deciding whether or not to continue with the employment relationship. In this week's podcast, we look at the capability procedure and the factors that an employer needs to consider when dismissing an employee on grounds of ill health. We look at a recent case and deal with some of the trickier issues that employers can face in these situations. We also consider the impact of the government's new Fit for Work service. I'm joined this week by employment law editor Fiona Cumming, who is going to talk us through the procedure. A very warm welcome to you, Fiona.
Hello, Sue.
It's important to be clear before we start that we're talking here about the stage when the employee has been off long-term sick and dismissal is being considered. It will probably be helpful, Fiona, if you start by reminding us where ill health dismissals fit within the statutory dismissal provisions.
Yeah, of course. Well, a dismissal for ill health, that's a dismissal for capability, and capability is one of the potentially fair reasons for dismissal. Now, capability, it's assessed by reference to skill, aptitude, health, or any other physical or mental quality. So an employee will be incapable of performing his or her job properly if she or he is absent due to ill health.
Potentially, then, you can dismiss someone on long-term sickness absence. It is one of the potentially fair reasons for dismissal. So an employee who is off sick for a prolonged period of time can be fairly dismissed if they are unlikely to be well and capable enough to return to their work.
Yes, potentially. But ill health dismissals aren't ever really straightforward. So establishing that capability is the reason for dismissal, well, that's important, but it's not sufficient in itself because employers will still need to show, as always, that they followed a fair procedure and that they've acted reasonably in all the circumstances of the case.
Okay, well, you mentioned a fair procedure there. Let's pick up on that. So what are the key elements for a fair procedure in ill health cases? They're essential, aren't they?
Oh, they are indeed. Actually, I think it's very helpful if we look at a relatively recent case, and this is a case of BSV Dundee City Council. Now, although this is a Scottish Court of Session case and it's not binding on employment tribunals in England and Wales, it does give valuable guidance and it does remind us of the golden rules here.
Before we consider the guidance provided in that case, BS and Dundee City Council, can you tell us the facts of the case?
I can, but the facts are a bit convoluted, so I'll try and keep to the bare bones. So in this case, the employee had been on sickness absence for about 9 months when the council met with him in August to discuss his latest occupational health report. Now, at the end of the meeting, the council warned him that if he failed to return to work by the 14th of September, it would actually consider dismissing him. Now, the employee saw the occupational health doctor again on the 11th of September, and the health doctor indicated that while his health was improving and he could be expected to return to work within 1 to 3 months. And in the meantime, the employee also saw his GP, and his GP signed him off for a further 4 weeks, which meant that he did not return to work by the deadline that the council had given him. So the council invited the employee to another meeting, and this actually took place 9 days after they had given the deadline date for his return to work. And at that meeting, the employee told the council he didn't think he'd be able to return to work anytime soon, and the council responded by dismissing him for capability on the basis that he wasn't going to be returning to work in the foreseeable future. The employee appealed that internally. It was unsuccessful, and he brought an unfair dismissal claim.
Well, this case is a good example. These facts aren't unusual. It's a common situation for employers. You see that very often in practice. The employer just plucks a return date out of the air rather than relying on the medical evidence. And what was the tribunal's decision in that case?
Well, the tribunal found the dismissal was unfair, and this was because they thought there were a number of defects in the procedure, and it considered that no reasonable employer would have dismissed an employee 9 days after receiving a report indicating that he may return to work within 1 to 3 months.
So I think that's important to remember that the prognosis, how long the illness is going to last, has to be either they'll never be able to come back or cannot say with any reasonable certainty that they'll be back in the foreseeable future. If the end is in sight, employers are usually expected to wait for the employee to return. But this wasn't the end of the case, was it?
No, the council appealed to the EAT, and the EAT decided that the tribunal had in actual fact made an error of law because the tribunal had failed to consider how long the council could be expected to wait for the employee to return to work. And the EAT decided in these circumstances that the case should go back to the tribunal, and the employee appealed that decision, and it was that appeal that went to the Court of Session.
And the course of session gave the guidance that you mentioned earlier.
It did. And while it agreed with the EAT that the case should be remitted back to the tribunal, it was critical of some aspects of the EAT's decision. So it took this opportunity to restate the necessary steps that an employer should take when contemplating an ill health dismissal.
Okay, and what was that first step?
Well, this is a very important step, and it's the need to really find out about the employee's medical condition and his or her likely prognosis. And in this case, in short, the court said that it really meant obtaining proper medical evidence.
Well, the case that you've mentioned, the employer did obtain several of its own occupational health reports. So what did they mean here by proper medical evidence?
Well, proper medical evidence is probably always going to depend on the particular circumstances and the nature of the particular illness. For example, it would be reasonable, I'd say, to rely on a GP report if the report was detailed and it gave a clear prognosis and that particular GP had the relevant expertise or knowledge of the illness in question. However, well, some illnesses, because of their very nature, may require a specialist opinion or a detailed report. So, for example, this could be conditions such as lupus, or if someone's had a suspected stroke, or that they've got an orthopaedic condition. So really, when assessing medical evidence, it's important to consider that the correct questions have been asked and answered. And this is because employers will be exposed in ill health dismissal tribunal cases if they dismiss on the basis of an unclear or vague prognosis.
So it's important that clear instructions are sent to the medical expert, particularly if you're asking about reasonable adjustments, if the employee may be disabled, mm-hmm. or where, as you say, the medical condition may be unusual, say lupus, or if the employee is seeing a hospital specialist. The employer really needs to think about who they obtain the report from, but in most cases the GP report will be sufficient, won't it? But as you say, clear instructions will be crucial.
Absolutely. And the instructions really must include basically all the questions that an employer wants answered. So just to recap, it would be the nature of the illness, the prognosis, the effect of the illness on him or her, and as you mentioned, any reasonable adjustments that could be made, and whether or not the employee would be deemed to be disabled under the provisions of the Equality Act. It's also important that the employer sets out what the employee's job actually entails, because it might be, depending on the medical advisor's opinion, that the employee could undertake some of the duties of that role, or lighter duties, or perhaps work from home, or be well enough to undertake an alternative role in the organisation. And I'll be mentioning this again later, but an employer must always consider alternative employment in ill health dismissal cases.
Of course. And you mentioned there about obtaining a medical report. Employers are often confronted with an employee who refuses to permit a medical report or undergo a medical examination. Can you just remind us of what the position is there?
Yes, certainly. Well, employees aren't obliged to undergo medical examinations or agree to the disclosure of their medical records unless, of course, you know, there's a clause in their contract of employment. However, if an employee is reluctant, then it's very helpful if an employer does actually find out the reason why, because it might be for a minor reason. For example, it might be because the date to see the medical advisor clashes with another medical appointment, or it could be that the employee has problems travelling to the appointment. And it really is important for an employer to stress that they need to have medical evidence, because if they don't have that evidence, then they will be making decisions based on the information that they do have, which will more than likely be to the detriment of the employee in those circumstances.
And you brought out an important point there, because employers are often concerned where employees don't agree to a medical examination or report, but the employee does actually risk being dismissed, don't they? Because the mm-hmm. employer only has to consider the evidence before it, and if there's no medical report, he won't need to consider it. It can be difficult to obtain reports. GPs are often very busy and it can take many weeks. And it's important for HR to remember to diarise every couple of weeks to make sure they keep on top of it to stop the matter drifting. Are there any other matters employers need to consider when obtaining medical reports?
Yes, there are. Well, they need to comply with the legal requirements set out in the Access to Medical Reports Act 1988, and they also need to be mindful of the General Medical Council guidance.
Well, that sounds very technical. Can you remind us in a nutshell what the General Medical Guidance is?
Yes, of course. Well, when an employer seeks an employee's consent to obtain a medical report, it is obliged to inform the employee of his or her rights under this Act. Now, if the medical adviser has been responsible for the care of the employee, such as a GP, then the employee has the right not only to see a copy of that report as soon as it is prepared, but also has the right to ask the relevant adviser to remove information or to refuse to allow the adviser to release the report to the employer. Now, the position is slightly different with reports prepared by an independent doctor who hasn't been responsible for the care of the employee. Now, the General Medical Council guidance for those doctors who are acting as independent medical advisers is that they must show the employee a copy of their report before it is sent and then obtain an employee's written consent before passing on a report. But the difference is that the guidance doesn't give employees the right to amend the report, although it's likely that most doctors would be willing, in fact, to correct factual inaccuracies.
So in practical terms, disclosing medical reports to employees means that it can take a bit of time before an employer receives the report, and particularly if an employee wants to make amendments to it.
Yes, and this really means that employers must factor the amount of time it might take to receive a report into their absence management process and ensure that they request a report as soon as it is apparent they will need one.
Okay, thanks for that, Fiona. We've covered the first step, i.e. the duty to obtain proper medical evidence. What was the second step?
Well, once you've got your medical evidence, you really need to consult properly with the employee prior to any dismissal. So this would involve discussing the medical evidence and also getting the employee's own thoughts on the current state of their health and when they think they will be well enough to return. And the employee's views will need to be taken into account and weighed against the views of any medical advisor. And of course, if the employer is contemplating dismissal, then this must be made fully clear to the employee.
So consultation with the employee is equally important as the step of obtaining a report. Any other steps?
Yes, and this is the final key element mentioned by the court, and it really is vital in every ill health dismissal case. And this is that it's essential to consider the question of whether the employer could be expected to wait any longer before dismissing. And this is because there is no time limit in law after which it is fair to dismiss an employee. So the key question is whether or not, in all the circumstances, the employer can reasonably be expected, in light of the requirements of the business, to wait any longer for the employee to recover and return to work. So it's a balancing exercise between the employer's need for work really to be done and the employee's need for time to recover their health.
As you say, there is no time limit. It is just when the employer can no longer be expected to wait for them to return, and often employers jump too soon. As you say, it is a balancing exercise. And what other factors that employers should consider?
Well, in addition to the medical evidence and the employee's views on the matter, it could include whether the employee had exhausted his or her sick pay entitlement, the nature of the employee's job itself, how the employer's been able to cover the employee's duties, and how the employee's absence has affected other employees and the business as a whole. So each of these factors is important, but not of itself determinative, and it will depend on the particular circumstances, and as usual, more will always be expected of larger employers.
So lots of factors to consider. Any other matters to be taken into account?
Yes, as I mentioned earlier, this is the one of alternative employment, and employers should always consider this in cases of ill health dismissals, as a failure to do so will make a dismissal unfair. So just to reiterate, it could be light duties or working from home, or indeed another role within the organisation. And as we've mentioned, it's also important that an employer considers any reasonable steps that it could take to enable the employee to return to work, and especially if the employee was deemed disabled within the meaning of the Equality Act, because then, of course, the employer, as we know, could be liable for disability discrimination as well as unfair dismissal. So, you know, employers would be thinking about things like a phased return, shorter hours, part-time working, you know, working some days from home. You know, these are just some examples.
And it's quite an important step, isn't it, that some employers miss the duty to consider reasonable adjustments. We haven't gone into it in any detail today. Mm. And also the issue of suitable alternative employment. Well, that's very helpful, the overview on ill health dismissals. It's very important to dot all the I's and cross the T's. Let's look at some of the tricky issues now that employers face regarding long-term sickness absence. Can you tell us whether an employee who has two jobs can continue working for one employer while being signed off sick by another?
Yes. Well, look, the position here is going to depend on the nature of the two jobs, and the employee won't have a problem doing that if the roles are actually different. Now, this probably can best be seen by a recent case where the employee worked, where she had two jobs at two different NHS trusts. Now, the one with Imperial Trust involved travel and physical activity, and the one at Ealing Trust was desk bound. Now, the employee in this case, she had a knee condition, so she was signed off from working for Imperial and she received sick pay from Imperial, but she continued working in her job with Ealing. Now, Imperial found out that she was working in her second job with Ealing and they dismissed her. This all ended up in a tribunal, and the tribunal found her dismissal was unfair, and they held that an employee can be medically unfit for work under one contract while still capable of work under another, provided there is no overlap in the hours. So this means that in this case, it would only have been a problem for the employee if she'd been carrying on her job with Ealing in the hours that she would have otherwise been working for Imperial.
Thank you. And another issue, can an employee who is absent from work due to an injury that occurred at work be dismissed by their employer?
Yes, and happily the case law is now quite clear on this issue. The Court of Appeal confirmed that an employer is not prevented from dismissing an employee in such circumstances. And the reason for this is because the reasonableness of an employer is dependent on the reasonableness of the employer's actions at the time of dismissal and not on its responsibility for the employee's incapacity. However, this is with the caveat that the Court of Appeal did state that an employer would be expected to go the extra mile in relation to an absence that it has effectively caused.
So there's no prohibition against dismissing the employee. The employer will be expected to go the extra mile in those cases.
Yeah, absolutely.
What sort of things would the employer be expected to do, Fiona?
Well, just to give a couple of examples, this could involve making more effort to find alternative work for the employee, or maybe tolerating a slightly longer period of sickness absence before dismissing him or her.
That's very helpful. Thank you very much, Fiona. This year, the government introduced the new Fit for Work service. I want you to get your crystal ball out now, Fiona, and tell us, what do you think will be the impact on these types of cases?
Well, the aim of this service is to give employees and employers occupational health advice that will assist in getting the employee back to work more quickly after an injury or illness. Now, it's a free service, and as we know, it's in its early stages because it's only being rolled out, expected to be fully available by autumn. So, sorry, I don't have a crystal ball. It's too early to say exactly how it's working in practice and whether it will actually have an important impact. But what I can say it will mean is that employers will need to be reviewing their sickness absent procedures to take into account how or the extent that they will utilise this service, because it is voluntary in respect of their existing occupational health requirements.
Thank you very much for a very helpful and comprehensive overview of a very complicated area.
Thank you, Sue.
For more information on ill health capability dismissals, which we have been discussing today, you will find a wealth of information on our website, including how-tos on how to deal with employees on long-term sickness and how to obtain and use medical reports on employees, as well as a line manager briefing on long-term sickness absence. We also have an upcoming webinar, which is a special Q&A session on dismissals, which will cover ill health capability dismissals, which is on the 1st of July, presented by our regular speakers, Darren Newman and Laurie Anstis. Registration has already opened, and you're also given the opportunity to ask three questions when you register. That brings us to the end of this week's Expert HR Weekly, which you've been listening to with me, Susan Dennehy. We are back again next Friday, but until then, it's goodbye from us.
Expert HR Weekly, the latest from experthr.co.uk, the award-winning subscription service for HR professionals.